You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Ed Song, associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And for whatever reason, I had to reach for that. How you doing, Ed?
I am well.
Things are recovering out there, like grass is starting to grow again. Buildings are being rebuilt.
I guess, but I mean, the scale of the destruction was so extensive. I'm trying to remember some statistic about the amount of silt and mud that came down from the mountains, and like how it was. But it was something like I'm just making up a number, but like 80,000 truckloads need to be removed. But I know a lot about geology now.
Sure.
My tendency in disasters like this is just like, I just want to know. I want to know and understand and try to comprehend. And there have been a few really amazing resources just talking about the geology of the region and how mudslides happen and all these crazy, crazy things. Yeah, so I'm pursuing a kind of a second PhD in geology. How about you? You're presumably not studying geology, but studying diaper changing and schedule juggling.
Right. Avoiding ice storms is kind of the activity of this week. We've had a couple of small ones. I mean, nothing major, but just enough to make it kind of dodgy to be out on the roads. So still weather related, but nothing nearly as intense as you guys have had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing nearly as intense as liberals have gone through in the past couple of years. So how is that for a segue?
You, Coyle Neal, are a radio professional.
There you go. Well, we've been doing this for what, 2 years now, coming up on it?
Something like that.
Without the accountability of having to please advertisers, which is really nice.
Oh, you know, you actually remind me something. Can I give a shout out?
Am I getting paid for it?
I got a free thing of coffee out of the deal.
Okay, go for it.
I would like to announce that Vega Coffee is the official coffee of the City of Man podcast.
Wait. I didn't agree to that.
So among the things that I do at the college is I'm involved with a downtown Westmont is what it's called. It's run out of our Center for Social Entrepreneurship. It's basically like an off-campus program that revolves around students going into intensive internship experiences with the goal of just sort of building capacity and problem-solving skills so that students can make a difference in the work world after they graduate. Anyway, so we're placing students into a lot of internships, and there are a surprising amount of startups and things like that in Santa Barbara. And so among them is Vega Coffee, which is this really great local coffee company. So the idea of fair trade coffee is now relatively ubiquitous. But their strategy is to try to get even more of the money that you spend on coffee beans or at Starbucks into the hands of growers by having growers roast in country, right? So that's the big step. So instead of getting $1 a pound, which is what they get in regular old coffee markets, or like $2 a pound, which is what they would get from more fair trade coffee vending, they get like $4 a pound because they're growing it, they're roasting it, they're shipping it.
So you're saying you literally cannot buy freshly roasted coffee at this place?
Well, it's like all mail order. And so what the company does is they basically solved a lot of like really complicated logistic problems. So the coffee is grown and roasted by coffee farmers in, I guess, Nicaragua is where they are now. And so it's cool. You can just sign up for a subscription and then every 2 weeks – your bag of coffee will just show up at your house, having been roasted like a day or two before. literally in Nicaragua. Anyways, I was meeting the founder of the company for the first time a few weeks ago. Actually, probably a couple months ago at this time, and she arranged to send me a free bag. It was really delicious. It was pretty cool. So I was like, I'll give you a shout out on her podcast. So go check out vegacoffee.com and drink better coffee for a good cause.
And I will go ahead and announce that we will at some point do a coffee and politics podcast. I can't believe we haven't done one yet.
Yeah, that's fun. And we can. Are you like a coffee snob kind of a person?
I'm not. I mean, I like good coffee, but I will drink whatever, basically. The wife is the mm-hmm. coffee snob of the two of us. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it's like in all seriousness, like the things that coffee has done to aspects of our political discourse. So like the like mm-hmm. you mentioned the whole buy local thing. I think you mentioned that. I heard it in my head, even if you didn't say it, which, of course.
Are you hearing voices again, Coyle?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've talked about this.
Coming through these magic wires that are connected to my computer. Right, so the buy local movement, right? You, unless you live in Hawaii, you can't buy coffee locally in the United States, right? So then what does that mean functionally for that kind of supporting local businesses and whatever? And then it becomes, well, buy coffee that's roasted locally, but then, of course, that's not necessarily helping out the, like you point out, the people who are growing it, who have a genuine need.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
Hey, so we could totally do that. I could interview, we could interview one or both of the founders of this company, and we could also do like a tasting and stuff. Like I could arrange for both of us to get a couple bags. And she, Nushin is her name, is like a certified, I don't even know what the word is, but like, whatever the equivalent of being like a highly trained wine sommelier is for coffee.
I have no idea.
And so she's an expert coffee taster. So like we could talk the politics of coffee as well as like the I don't know, the experience of drinking coffee. That'd be kind of fun, wouldn't it?
I completely agree. Back to our
part two of our series on Trump and its effects on the parties.
Right. So a couple of episodes back, we talked about what's happening in conservatism and what the effect of Trump has been and where conservatism may or may not be going. Today, we're going to look at the other side, what's happening on the left with liberalism or progressivism. I will probably rightly or wrongly use those two terms interchangeably today. But if conservatism has taken a beating over the past few years or decades or whatever, as we talked about a couple of episodes back, if conservatism has gone into decline, then in the 2016 election, at least politically, liberalism was utterly trounced. So that, I think, is something that merits reflection. And fortunately, we have a thoughtful liberal on this program. So, Ed.
Oh, who's your guest? Did you get somebody in? Oh, wait a second. Me. Right. Oh,
it's
okay.
You. It's you, Ed. The man behind the curtain is Edward Song. Ed, tell us a little bit about liberalism before Trump. Tell us about the good old days, the days of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and I don't even know. I mean, before that, I get a little fuzzy. I guess Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah. So I guess it depends on how far you want to go. But the Democratic Party is so the Republican Party was born as an anti-slavery movement. It is the party of Lincoln. The Democratic Party has its roots almost all the way back to the founding. It was sort of the agrarian anti-federalist party of Jefferson. And you know, there's just this interesting way in which the history of the parties have totally flipped. I mean, going back that far for the Democratic Party probably isn't so useful for understanding where we are at now. The more immediate point of interest historically is going back to FDR's New Deal coalition.
Right.
So in the wake of the Great Depression at Franklin Delano Roosevelt's rise, his personal political success and the success of the Democratic Party at the time was built upon assembling this really interesting New Deal coalition coming out of the wake of the Great Depression, which included unions and blue-collar workers, racial minorities, which had historically been members of the Republican Party for their role fighting against slavery, but were increasingly attracted, these racial minorities, to the kinds of New Deal programs that FDR was implementing. Equally, farmers and white Southerners, as well as educated professionals. So that was this incredibly powerful coalition that kept FDR in power, as well as the Democratic Party in control of Congress through the 40s and 50s. But that coalition splintered in the 60s, largely over the Vietnam War and the rising counterculture. And basically what happened was the party re-coalesced as a largely urban party serving the interests of educated professionals, still the racial minorities, and what was left of the unions. And again, a lot of this happened in response to the party's opposition to the Vietnam War. And these really interesting things were going along between the 1968 election and the 1972 election. The 1968 election, in which Humphrey was the Democratic nominee, despite having not run through any of the political primary process, right? And the party sort of officially beat back any kind of anti-Vietnam platform in the plank. And then when 72 rolled around, McGovern was the nominee, and there was sort of this violent reaction in which McGovern came to power. It was very much on an anti-war platform. And it wasn't just the interests of the party that shifted, but really the nature of the party. So I was rereading this interesting article from George Packer in The New Yorker that was published, this seems like ancient history now, but that was published on Halloween of 2016, those innocent days, talking about, the title of the article is Hillary Clinton and the Populist Revolt, talking about the possibilities that Hillary Clinton could reach out to that disaffected white working class voter that was fueling Trump's rise. But I mean, he talks in a really interesting way about like the history of this transformation in the Democratic Party. And McGovern's ascendancy, which was staffed by the likes of Gary Hart, Bill Clinton, his new girlfriend and wife, Hillary Clinton, and really the introduction of these highly educated idealists who were shifting the Democratic coalition from a kind of an economic populism to more of a cultural populism. And what happened in 72, McGovern was trounced, Nixon came into power, Nixon begat Reagan, with Carter in between. And by the time that the 90s rolled around, Clinton himself was now ready. He had been governor in Arkansas for a long time. Clinton was elected governor in 1992. And then you sort of got the full development of this this kind of cultural liberalism. Clinton in some ways ran on a kind of a platform of economic populism, but that was quickly abandoned. I mean, in large part due to political realities. But Clinton actually governed more or less like a moderate Republican. His budgets were long on budget hawkishness and deficit reduction. And by the end of his tenure in the 90s, he really had sort of come to embrace deregulation and like Wall Street financial interests. The big deregulation act that was authored by Phil Graham and sort of passed in a midnight vote at the very tail end of Clinton's presidency and then signed into law. Sorry, I can't remember how I began that sentence. Anyways, the deregulation bill that basically begat the financial catastrophe of 2008, that was on Clinton's watch. And so you really got this transformation of the FDR New Deal coalition, unions, blue-collar workers, racial minority, really the party of the working class, to kind of this technocratic, highly educated, cosmopolitan, elite Democratic Party of Clinton. And, Obama, I think in many ways Obama was more progressive than Clinton, but still kind of championing still committed to Wall Street interests and still kind of championing a kind of a cultural progressivism. And then, you know, you had mentioned earlier, like, this trouncing that that Democrats received. And certainly there was a trouncing that spurred a lot of reflection and second-guessing. But, like, it's also kind of the case that, like, any candidate, like, any normal Democratic candidate would have trounced Trump, don't you think?
I mean, yeah, I go back and forth on that. On most days, I would say yes. Any other candidate, I would say. On the other hand, what is Hillary Clinton if not a normal Democratic candidate? I mean, she's Democratic on the issues. She's certainly an establishment Democratic figure. I mean, if you're looking to put a face on the Democrats from the second half of the 20th century, mm-hmm. I don't know that you could do much better than Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. So, and one interesting thing about this George Packer New Yorker article is that, I mean, he has it's built around what I assume is pretty extensive interviews with Clinton. And, like, some of her quotes in it are really, really interesting. And, I mean, you can raise questions about the extent to which she is just responding to the shifts of the political winds. But, like, I think there's a lot of really sort of compelling concern in a lot of the things that she talks about economic policy and the extent to which, you know, certain parts of the country have been left out in the cold. And so you can really see her trying to sort of assemble what is like a modest and incrementalist economic policy, but nevertheless sort of one geared towards trying to make sure that all of the people who didn't benefit from the economic expansions of the 90s and early aughts, that is to say, working class persons, to make sure that the benefits of that expansion got to them. So in some ways, I mean, I actually think that her policies were geared towards addressing a lot of these issues. The problem was, I mean, and you're right, I mean, she's certainly an establishment Democratic figure. I mean, the problem with her had nothing to do with her policies. It had everything to do with the fact that, well, there were the emails, but the emails sort of fit into this narrative about who Clinton was as a person. I mean, the reason she lost was just because she's uniquely unlike for an American politician.
Right. And I mean, I think there's we could talk more about Clinton. I do want to ask you though, maybe to separate some of this out from the Democratic Party, just because I think just as you shouldn't necessarily tie the Republican Party and conservatism too tightly together, the same thing with the Democratic Party and liberalism. Yes, I think that is it happens fairly often that the two parties line up that way. But at the end of the day, the both political parties, both Republicans and Democrats, what the parties themselves care about is mm-hmm. winning the election. And whatever it takes to win the election, they will do if they think that by, you know, taking conservative positions on everything tomorrow, the Democrats would win more elections mm-hmm. than they would take conservative positions because they're political parties. And that's one of the reasons these two parties have hung around so long. And one of the reasons that you can't say, hey, the Republicans today are just the same as the Republicans of, you know, 1860. It's because there's this internal flexibility that adjusts to the times and adjusts to the electoral circumstances. So can you maybe talk a little bit about not just the party politics side of things, but what did liberals believe in prior to Trump? So you've mentioned that in some of the coalitions. I can you bring that out to the front, right? Instead of just the implications of, you know, the working class and the minorities and so on. Can you say sort of explicitly what their statement of faith would have been if there had been such?
Well, yeah. I mean, so to a certain extent, I think liberals in the 20th century always saw themselves as the party for those who just wanted a fair shake in life. You know, they were historically the party of the little guy, protecting the interests of working class voters, which include, you know, unionists, blue collar workers, racial minority, white Southerners. And I mean, you know, one way to think about it, I commend one of our very first episodes on liberalism as a political ideology. Faithful listeners will remember my long detour into the intricacies of John Rawls' political philosophy. But it is a political philosophy rooted in this conception of human beings as having some certain fundamental rights and liberties. And those rights and liberties sort of spell out for Rawls in terms of two principles of justice. One has to do with like guaranteeing the kinds of civil rights and liberties that we care about. So like one is kind of very rights focused. The other has to do with like wealth and having the material conditions to live a minimally decent life. So the point is that liberalism historically just like has these two prongs. People having these liberties, people having equal access to material resources to live minimally decent lives. And you know, historically you can see those two forces at work in the 20th century. A concern for racial equality, for example, in the civil rights movement. Concern for the economic well-being of the working class. And then I would just kind of say, like in the 60s, with the Vietnam War, with the counterculture, there was a little bit more of an embrace of that rights-oriented aspect. It was more of a cultural liberalism that was concerned about. I mean, like, these are things that I'm concerned about too, but it was sort of like weighting cultural issues and de-emphasizing economic issues, if that makes sense.
And would it be fair to say that the sort of linchpin, that the, you know, philosophical undergirding that runs through all of these different positions, so you know, rights and economics and even the anti-Vietnam stuff to some extent, is a concern to protect the individual, right? Particularly the individual in a liberal sense of the phrase. I hate to do that because you're using the term to define the term, but the autonomous individual, I guess, maybe a way to put it. The desire to protect the integrity of the individual from external coercion in ways that violate the basic humanity of the person.
Yeah, I guess so. Though I tend to dislike that talk of individualism. I mean, that's certainly an element in a lot of liberal political thought, and like an important one. I tend to, though, sort of worry. Well, there are two kinds of worries. On the one hand, it tends to encourage, I think, like one way of thinking about liberal political thought that I think isn't necessarily the best way. I mean, this is a way that really sort of does emphasize like this individual, the exercise of autonomy for its own sake is a good for the individual. Ties and connections to communities is an important, like, I don't think that's what liberalism is about, but sometimes it's sort of associated with that. But then, you know, the other thing is that, like, that thing that you just said about liberal individualism, I mean, that's something that that a libertarian would very happily sign on to.
Well, right. So, and that's why I tried to nuance that a little bit with not an individual necessarily in the sense that I'm free to do whatever I want as long as I'm not hurting anyone else. That's certainly the libertarian view. But the individualism in the sense that I as an individual should be free to flourish as a human being, right? Which is how you get the rights and the economic view at the same time. So the libertarian is going to focus just on the rights. The modern liberal is going to say, yeah, rights, but also part of the function of society is to make sure, as you said, that the person has kind of a basic standard of living. Well, why does the person have a basic standard of living? Because you're living the more fully human life.
Yeah, there are different ways of getting at those the concern for economic well-being. I mean, one way is by appealing to rights of equality, right? And so then understood in a more robust way than a libertarian would. Not necessarily like a final equality of ends, but at least a robust conception of equality of opportunity. I mean, that I think is probably the best way to get at it. And so, you know, liberals and libertarians are committed to a fundamentally right-centered view. They differ on, well, how libertarians think of property rights, for one thing, and how liberals have a more robust account of equality. That's what I would say, I guess.
Right. Well, into all of this mix, like a bomb in a playground, right, drops Donald Trump. I think that's the Bart quote, right? He was like the bomb in the playground of the theologians. Donald Trump shows up and just smashes everyone mm-hmm. to smithereens. So what are the effects, if you don't, unless you had something else to
No, add no, no, that's back. Good.
What are the effects of Trump on liberalism or progressivism, I guess, to use its updated term?
There's a way in which I think there are probably some liberals or progressives, maybe especially sort of establishment Democratic Party types of the old Clinton wing, who might say, look, the only reason we lost is because we had a uniquely unpopular candidate and, you know, her opposition was aided by meddling from foreign countries.
And she never went to Michigan. So,
yeah.
In the last 2 weeks.
Yeah. So mistakes that she made as a candidate, if the, you know, the influence of the FBI investigation, like, you know, all of that stuff. And she did win the popular vote, even if she lost the electoral vote pretty handily. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who, maybe especially of the Clinton wing, who say, look, it's a mistake to make too much of this. We should just stay the course. We can put up any old bozo in the next election and we're going to win, which I think is probably true. Like, if Biden...
Look at Alabama, right? I mean...
Yeah. And I gather that they just won another election for a state congressional seat in a district that Trump dominated in, like, Wisconsin or something like that. But anyways, if Biden was the nominee instead of Clinton, if Biden runs in the next election, like, I, you know, then the narrative looks very different. And we're sort of talking about, like, Obama's legacy, whatever, you know, whatever that might be.
He won't be running in the next election, though. You know that, right?
Do we know that?
He's 75.
Well, yeah, but, you know, 75 is the new 55.
Yeah, but in the next election, he'll be, what, 78?
Yeah, so probably not. Probably not. But whoever it is, and, you know, there is the crew of people who are trying to promote national profiles and all of that. Like, you know, I think whoever it is probably almost certainly going to win. I guess we talked about this a little bit last time.
Right.
Unless Trump doesn't run, which I think is probably better than 50-50, and then maybe it gets a little bit harder. But in any case, you can sort of see a lot of people saying, look, we shouldn't overreact to this. We got the next one, and we can just continue on with this kind of this post-Clinton political philosophy. But, like, you know, I think that would be a mistake. And what you're seeing in the Democratic Party, is, like, this fracturing, right, between the old Clinton wing that is very pro-business and relatively moderate on economic matters over and against, well, the Bernie Sanders wing. I mean, he's not technically a Democrat, but in any case, you know, that more progressive coalition that wants to return to this more economic populism. And so you have Sanders himself, as well as other pretenders, maybe chief among them is Elizabeth Warren and others. So I think, you know, you're having this struggle in the Democratic Party about how to respond to this. And then I guess I would just say that, like I think it's a mistake to see the Trump election as an aberration. I mean, in a certain sense, I think it definitely is an aberration. But if Trump himself hadn't won, then there would be somebody Trump-like who would be in his place. And that's, again, because there is this large segment of American society of white working class voters that rightly feel disenfranchised. And they've been disenfranchised by the economic policies of the last 30 years. I mean, they've been disenfranchised by, you know, in a lot of ways by factors that were beyond the control of the United States. So just like globalization in general. The writing's been on the wall, and the writing would be on the wall, NAFTA or no NAFTA. But the fact of the matter is they've been left behind by the economic policies of Reagan and of Bush 1 and of Clinton and of Bush 2, and to a lesser extent, but to still an extent, I think, by Obama. And they're pissed, you know? And I think they're right to be pissed. There's been incredible economic expansion since the 90s, and like they just haven't benefited. And their interests haven't been represented by the Republican Party, who are happy to pass tax cuts that benefit the wealthiest of Americans, but do nothing for middle class workers. And then equally, the Democrats haven't done much to help them. And so, you know, whether or not another Democratic candidate would have beaten Trump, I think in some ways is immaterial. What matters isn't Trump. What matters is Trump's message. And I mean, I would really like to see the Democratic Party return and try to rebuild that old FDR coalition. Still care about cultural issues, but emphasize more economic ones and try to return to a kind of an economic populism and try to rebuild that coalition of unions and blue collar workers and white Southerners, white working class Southerners, by trying to offer a kind of an economic package that recognizes their real interests.
Yeah. So, and I guess that gets into the next question then is what, where does progressivism need to go? I don't know that I've really heard any. You sent me several articles to read in prep for this, and one of the articles talked about how the liberals basically need to remember that national borders matter, right? Mm-hmm. There is a place for patriotism, and there is a place for nationalism, and so on, as long as it's patriotism and nationalism rightly understood. But beyond that, in most of these articles, I don't know that I saw any of the sort of soul searching that has happened at least occasionally on the right when you set aside some of the triumphalism after the 2016 election. I don't know that I saw any of them saying, you know what, maybe Americans just don't want this thing, right, that we're doing. It's we need to keep doing this thing and then add something else to it in a way that occasionally sounded sort of like let's throw the ignorant peasants their crumbs and then we'll still be able to do our social and cultural policies behind the scenes as long as we put on a good show. I don't know that that's what they meant, but that is occasionally what it sounded like. And I'm sort of curious to hear your thoughts on that. And I realize that for our listeners, I'm referencing an article that we haven't talked about, so maybe we should talk about it first, and then get into some of the questions. This is the "What's Next for Liberalism" article, right?
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Yeah, Democracy Journal magazine.
So, I mean, I think certainly in the wake of Trump's victory, there was a lot of soul searching. Now, I think some people took that soul searching and drew different lessons from it. I mean, I agree with you that, again, I would sort of call them the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. That was like, no, this was an aberration. We just need to stay the course. But I think,
which we'll know in a few months, right? I mean, when the House elections happen in 2018. Right, we'll see whether or not that's the case.
But then, you know, equally there was the Sanders wing, the more populist wing, that in a lot of ways is a pretty widespread grassroots movement. That in the last election, in that, you know, a lot of really interesting characters kind of swept into power. I mean, there was the what was the name of the fellow who won the Alabama election?
Doug Jones.
So that for one thing. But then a lot of really interesting, pretty progressive grassroots new politicians who swept into office in a variety of different places. that I think were motivated by a desire to sort of return to more of a grassroots economic populism. So, I mean, certainly there are lots of people who are just like, no, stay the course, it's fine. And, you know, among that new class of new members of Congress were like a number of transgender persons and prominent LGBTQ activists and things like that. But I think there really has been a kind of a revival of more grassroots economic populism. Maybe not enough for your tastes, but like I see that as being like a really healthy kind of a thing. And even a revival, and this goes with the Sanders thing, right? Of more, I saw that you just posted an article on Facebook actually about socialism.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance
mostly,
to read.
Mostly to throw a, mostly just to throw a firecracker. It's not the the most in-depth thing ever, but it basically talks about how fear is functionally what's driving people into this. Sort of the comforting promises of security in a world where we have done away with most of the institutions that in the past would have provided security. Family and local governments and Rotary clubs and all of those sorts of things. They've died off, and that leaves us basically with the state. And so you see people more and more turning kind of in that direction. Again, it's mostly bomb throwing, but I thought they were fun bombs. So
so that article is entitled "Why Are Young People Turning to Socialism?" It was on Patheos. Danny Anderson jumped in within like an hour of your posting. His comment was nuance. Ugh, Coyle. And then you can imagine where it goes.
And so I accomplished my purpose in posting that article by getting that response from Danny. But again, I think to be fair, I have not been following the soul searching on the left that you describe. I've basically read a handful of stuff here and there, and then the articles that you sent me for this. But even with the growth of economic populism, and maybe this is just characteristic of these particular articles. But it still sounds like they're saying, you know what, we'll just get these yokels some jobs so that we can go back to shutting down Christian bakers and compelling, you know, schools to let boys use the girls' bathroom and all of our other social agenda that we really want. Maybe that's too uncharitable a reading of it, but again, that is what it sounds like. Am I misreading this? Am I failing to understand this? Or is there like a genuine, no, we really do mean we want to go.
Yeah,
this other
so
direction.
That is a little bit of a hard question. I mean, I think there is this desire to pursue a more genuinely populist economic track. And I think it's uncharitable and pejorative to sort of like in the way that you characterize it, as in like in terms of just throwing these country rubes a bone. I mean, I think it's genuine recognition that like large scale economic forces have treated some people unfairly. And it's like, and it's only going to get worse. Like it really is only going to get worse. They're really, really hard economic questions that like we have to confront as a nation, as you know, the economy grows healthily. The stock market, at least up until, you know, a couple days ago, was really thriving. Lots of people are making insane amounts of money. But like the vast majority of Americans aren't able to participate in that. And globalization continues as a force. Rising technology, the advances in robotics and artificial intelligence is just going to increasingly replace the manufacturing jobs that exist. I mean, there's tons of manufacturing that's actually going on in the United States. The United States makes more stuff than it ever has in its history, but it's just that stuff is being made by robots with like, you know, a fraction of the number of workers that you needed. And these are extraordinarily significant problems. Extraordinarily significant problems. I'd love to do an episode on like technological unemployment. I guess we talked about some of that stuff when we did our Marxism episode. But anyways.
We did. So one of the articles that you sent me talked a little bit about that. And it actually – it did make the argument that, again, liberals have this tradition of kind of a globalism, but in a very, I guess, cultural sense is probably the best way to put that. And I don't remember the quote off the top of my head, but basically there's this famous famous liberal quote that maybe you can remember this functionally. It says that the person who's living in some random country around the world is just as valuable and just as good as, you know, the American citizen. And I certainly don't know any Christian who should ever disagree with that. And in general, I think that's a true statement. The author pointed out that Americans, however much they may agree or disagree with that, don't necessarily want to see that principle written into U.S. law. So again, there was this call for, hey, let's rethink some of this stuff. Now, do you think that's actually going on the left? Like, do you see progressives being willing to say, yes, we admit that people are equal, but, and I hate to use the phrase, but, you know, America first when it comes to governing our nation?
You mean like political progressives, not like political philosophers?
Oh yeah. Well, go either direction, right? So, I mean, I guess if you want to talk about the hierarchy of the Democratic Party, we can talk about what Donna Brazile really thinks.
Look,
about,
I mean,
you know, I mean, yeah, go with it any direction you want.
A lot of political progressives have internationalist visions, but it's not like they don't think that nations can rightly prioritize the interests of its citizens over others. I mean, immigration questions are, I mean, they're just kind of hard, and we could talk about them at length, but it's not like progressives don't think that countries, or the United States in particular, can't prioritize the interests of its own citizens. Like, nobody's saying that. I mean, I guess the immigration debate can sound like that a little bit, but that's also coupled with the sense that, like, immigration is actually good for our country, not bad for it. Good for the people who are here, not bad for it.
Let me see if I can find the actual.
No, but can I just finish off a thought from the last thing?
Yeah, like, yeah, go for it. Go for
you
it.
Were making this point about whether or not contemporary progressives have really gotten the memo, or whether they sort of still have this. They see the economic populism as just throwing a bone to these country rubes, and what they're really interested in are these cultural issues. I mean, I do think that's a hard issue, because, like, I think that they care about cultural issues, and they should rightly care about some of these cultural issues. I mean, we've talked about this stuff before. I think these things get complicated. I think that Christian bakers, I think this whole thing is ridiculous, but I think that nevertheless Christian bakers shouldn't be, that we can make an exemption for them, a pretty narrow exemption for them in terms of baking cakes for gay and lesbian persons. So I guess I agree with you on that. But, like, on the other hand, I think it's important to make sure that the rights of that everybody shares equal rights, that certain persons aren't subject to discrimination. You might not like them. You can't, just because you don't like them doesn't mean that you can shove them into a corner and deprive them of rights and pretend that they don't exist. Like this, like the transgender bathroom issues is—it's a total red herring for one thing, and a total stand-in for, like, wider debates about cultural morality. But look, if somebody wants to present themselves a particular kind of a way, you might not like it. That's fine, but, like, that doesn't mean that you can exclude them from society. So.
So
my big point is that, like, I think there should be a recommitment to certain values of economic populism. And I disagree with a lot of progressives on certain matters of religious liberty and tolerance. And I think you're right that the attitude of a lot of progressives on matters of religious liberty are incorrect. But with that said, I also think that there are all important matters of equal rights for minority groups that deserve respect, and that, like, you know, you a liberal can't give those things up. They're just a part of the things that we believe.
Right, which raises the question of whether or not that was what was rejected in the 2016 elections. And I think that's harder to answer, in part because Trump is so on board with so many of those things.
Mm-hmm.
As I was reading through the one of the articles you sent, and again, we will post all of these on the show notes. One of the articles talked about Richard Rorty, and we've talked about the idea that the left shifts from caring about politics to caring about culture in the 1960s. And now I'm forgetting, did we talk about that on the air or was that before the episode?
It was before the episode.
Okay, so the argument that this article makes is that, and this is a quote from the article, for Rorty, the left ceased to be political and instead became a cultural movement. The prevailing view was that it was no longer possible to promote equality and social justice within the system. And before the episode, I took a little bit of issue with that. I certainly agree that in the 60s, the left started decrying the system. I disagree that it stopped being political. I think it just started its long march through the institutions and culminated in Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. I mean, Bill Clinton himself certainly was a 60s radical in the office of president, although he didn't, as you pointed out, he didn't govern that way in terms of the things that, at least assuming that he has stayed somewhat consistent on his social policies and beliefs and so on, that's certainly what shaped him and his ideas. And then Barack Obama, the man who can, you know, simultaneously decry the system and use it to impose his agenda, which, again, my point is we can't really, at least it's very difficult to read the 2016 election as a rejection of that when those are all the same things that Donald Trump is saying. Right. There's no non-policy statement in everything I've just said that doesn't also apply to Donald Trump, you know, decrying the system and using it simultaneously to you know, recreate the self and the nation and God in whatever image he wants. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm interested in your thoughts on this. I mean, was 2016 a rejection of liberalism in general, or can we just not know because Trump is sort of in that stream, at least in that side of the stream?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, I think part of the rejection was the fact that there are a lot of Americans who are morally traditionalists that feel ill at ease in the changing world. For sure, that's a big part of it. And I think that there are still fundamental moral conflicts that exist between persons with regard to their visions of what our country should look like. I think the real problem, though, is that, like, accompanying that for a lot of people was a real sense of economic disenfranchisement and insecurity. And some people came in and really played on those fears and amplified those fears and manipulated those fears. But I guess I think that by re-emphasizing certain themes of economic populism, like the Democratic Party will be able to reassemble a really broad coalition and create the kinds of political and economic reforms that really drove, like, American prosperity in the middle part of the 20th century. But in a lot of ways, you know, We're playing out a story that was written a really long time ago, and, like, issues of difference and who belongs were issues that existed at the founding, that were sort of papered over and then reared its head again in the Civil War, and that was kind of papered over and reared its head again in the 60s and the Civil Rights Movement, and there are still fundamental differences that we need to work out. But I think bringing together people together on a pretty broad coalition of populist economic values will go a long way in terms of ratcheting down a lot of the kind of conflict and rancor that we experience.
And what do you see as being the sort of the core belief that ties this coalition together? Is it just economics? Or do you think there's going to be some kind of substance at bottom that says this is what we all believe that ties everyone across the spectrum who's part of the the Democratic Party or again liberalism more broadly or whatever.
I mean, it's returning that like that simple notion of like the Democratic Party is for the people. Like we want to make sure that everybody has a fair shake in the game, and that if you work hard and do right, that like you're going to be fine. That the fruits of economic prosperity are going to be made available to everybody. Everybody has a shot to get ahead. There are no barriers that are inhibiting anybody. And like you put that message together, and that's just a return to like FDR progressivism.
But that everything you just said there, I think any Republican could say that and agree with it. So what's going to distinguish?
Yeah, so the difference, the difference is obviously the Democrats mean it.
Right. I mean, a Republican is going to say you should work hard and benefit from your work.
Well, I mean, the Democrats are going to enact, the economic policies that actually achieve that, as opposed to what? As opposed to cutting taxes for the wealthy and cutting government programs, which isn't going to help anybody, I would say.
Well, again, but that's suggesting that there is more than just that that's at, sort of at bottom. So there's something, some specific idea running alongside it. Because again, if it's just a question of kind of practical application, you know, we all agree that you should be able to keep the fruits of your labor. And the only difference is, you know, whose vision is more effective. I mean, maybe our politics, that's the only thing that divides us, but it certainly feels like there's a deeper philosophical division between Americans than just that kind of surface level, my program's more effective than yours argument.
I don't disagree with that in a lot of ways. We were talking about this maybe off air the last time we recorded, but, you know, America is riven by a culture war. That phrase, culture war, like the revival of that phrase is largely due to the book that the UVA sociologist James Davison Hunter wrote in the early 90s, in which he was trying to offer kind of a sociological analysis of what our cultural divide was. And Hunter argues that it is fundamentally a debate between moral traditionalists and moral progressivists. And his thesis was really controversial through the 90s. The majority view amongst academic sociologists was that Hunter was wrong, and that when you actually looked at the demographic data, you couldn't find any significant enduring cleavages between classes of persons. And that's true. And Hunter always said that that was true, but that his argument was one that was primarily focused on elites, cultural and political elites on both sides, and that an interest in such elites was important because elites, again, both conservative and progressives, have outsized influence, have outsized cultural authority. And now I think the cultural war thesis is controversial to no one, precisely because like the thesis has been borne out. But I mean, all of this is just a long way of answering your questions that, yeah, I mean, I think that there is still a kind of a fundamental normative divide between moral traditionalists and moral progressivists.
Although I think I disagree with the argument that Republicans are moral traditionalists. But again, this isn't our conservatism episode, so we should keep it focused on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, we could unpack what that means, and as we talked about last time, the Republican Party is itself a kind of a motley coalition of various different things. But certainly, I mean, a kind of a moral traditionalism on matters of sexual morality is an important part of it, no?
Maybe in certain very limited cases. So more and more.
Limited case?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have Republicans increasingly embracing things like gay marriage, right? You have.
I mean, you say increasingly. I mean, how many Republican figures in the Senate or the House, like, are really openly in favor of marriage rights for homosexual persons?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know that whatever the number is, it has been growing. The most recent thing example of it I saw was the last CPAC convention, so the Conservative Political Action Conference, was made some news because of their inclusion of a maybe this wasn't the last one. Maybe this was a couple of years ago. Their inclusion of an openly homosexual speaker who spoke in favor of sort of the normalizing on the conservative side of things of homosexual marriage. And again, I think that is that is one of the places where I think the bulk of the Republicans are maybe still more in favor of traditional marriage, but that number is diminishing. So other sides of sexual morality, yeah. So abortion might be a place where you have kind of the traditional yeah. sexual morality. But again, you start getting into sort of broader questions that libertarian streak takes over. And once you're a libertarian, then there is room for being a moral progressive, right? Because you've now said, well, look, have whatever personal morality you want. That can include being a moral progressive. That can include things like favoring gay marriage, being more permissive when it comes to abortion and so on.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, to me, libertarianism isn't so much like full-blown moral libertarianism, but more a narrow kind of a libertarian account of property rights and a real embrace of free markets.
Right. I mean,
I was going to say,
look, if you look at I agree with you that in kind of the technical sense, that's right. But even at the Republican convention in 2016, where you have the speaker who introduces Donald Trump endorses gay marriage from the podium, right? And then Donald Trump doesn't come right out and say it, but comes pretty close to that in his acceptance speech. I think that's not resisted as much as it perhaps could have been because of this libertarian streak.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that, and I would certainly say that the direction in the Republican Party is towards marriage equality. But with that said, there's been tremendous growth in the number of Republicans who are in favor of it. But that's like growth from like 1 to 3, not like from 1 to, you know, 45.
Right. Well, and that's just one issue. Again, overall, the moral progressivism, increasingly it seems that the Republicans you have who personally hold a traditional ethic. Are often very clear that I hold this because I choose to hold it, but you can hold a different one, and that's fine. And again, that is sort of by definition being morally progressive, right? That's that idea of that sort of libertarian approach of I will have my idea and you have your idea, and that's fine. Well, once you've done that, you've given up the game and you're now on the other side, even if you disagree on the specific issues. So if the Democrats are moral progressives and the Republicans are moral progressives, or at least moving more and more in that direction, there is still a culture war. I'm not disagreeing with the thesis. It just has to be over something else.
Yeah. And so what do you think it's over?
Yeah, I don't know. That's the question.
I don't disagree with you that the Republican Party is moving in that direction. And that in 50 years, things aren't going to look very, very different. But for now, I mean, the rhetoric and the energy of the party is so deeply driven by like full-throated. I mean, not to say that these persons aren't ridiculous hypocrites, but like, you know, look at the Roy Moore election. I mean, it's all about this, like the trappings of moral traditionalism. Even Trump, you know, who is a libertine in the extreme, still sort of harkens back to certain kinds of, I don't know, honor code values. I mean, and, you know, I would say, like the writing's on the wall. I mean, since the Enlightenment, certain ideas of individual autonomy are working themselves out in our political institutions. That's just, it's inevitable. But I think in the long run, I'm going to win. I think my guys are going to win.
Oh, I certainly agree. No, I certainly agree with that. Every nation declines and falls, Ed. All of them. So you're going to win.
Yeah, because things were so much better in the ancient regime and in the good old days in Roman times. When women were animals and... it's not to say that I don't think that as... capital liberalism works itself out. I certainly don't think that it's like we're all just sort of walking into a rosy future.
Sure.
It brings with it tremendous stresses and strains that we need to navigate. I think sometimes you and I probably disagree on what exactly the stresses and strains are. I'm certainly, I guess, conservative and traditionalist on matters of personal morality, but would say that as a matter of justice, like, you know, right. You know what my views are on matters of sexual morality, but like, I believe in marriage equality just as a matter of justice.
Sure. Right. Which puts you in sort of the awkward place of having to swim against two streams at the same time. Right. Well, we should bring it back to the main topic. Anything to add on where progressivism needs to go, right? What needs to happen in the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years? Again, you can go the party politics route. You can talk sort of the philosophy of the movement. What do you think needs to happen post Trump?
Yeah, so I'm just reiterating, but like, you know, if the Democratic Party nominated a white Southern progressive man, there's no way he loses. I mean, you know, Southern Democrats always win. So if they nominated someone like, I mean, Kaine in some ways isn't, I like Tim Kaine fine. I still wondered the extent to which he's like an establishment, really an establishment.
I mean, he's not super charismatic, but yeah,
he's a super decent guy. I don't know how populist his economic policies are. And in a lot of ways, this is a super hard, it's going to be super hard for the Democratic establishment, which is as tied into Wall Street as the Republican establishment is.
Right.
But we'll see. But like, if the Democratic Party was able to cobble together this FDR coalition, they would never lose. Like if you put up a kind of a populist Southern male presidential candidate, I mean, I think they're going to win even if they put up Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker or Kamala Harris. That's her name, right? My senator. I think they probably win with any of them. But like if they put up a Southern populist white man, it's like he's going to win by 10 points.
I mean, if they want the landslide, they need to put up Oprah.
You know, Oprah, well, she isn't running. She would win, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she would win. Right. And like Donald Trump, she should not be president. So, I mean, I'm sort of automatically against anyone who has no government service being president.
Really?
Yes. I'm against a lot of people who do have government service being president. But if you have none... Yeah, you should not be able to step directly.
Yeah, so what's his name? Mark Cuban? That doesn't do anything for
you. Nope. Nope.
I don't disagree with you. I don't know that would make that a litmus test for myself. But
yeah, I'm fine with that as a.
And in some ways,
and it's I would apply that to David French too. There was some talk last summer
about
running him as an independent, and nope.
He served in the military at least.
He did. Still. If he had been a general, I would count that. Like, it doesn't mean he would be a good president, but at least, you know, at least you have run some kind of office, right? At least you've been in a position of some kind of authority where you're responsible for others and are part of the government somehow. So, yeah.
What official title do you hold again in Bolivar?
City collector.
You could run for president.
National government, some kind of federal.
Oh, federal. Say governor has to be sufficient for you.
Yeah. Okay. Governor might be. Yeah. Governor's fine, but that's also like you are doing the same job as a president, just on a smaller scale. So governor, senator, general, those are kind of the big three. Representative. If you've done it for long enough, or if you've been, you know, Speaker of the House, then yeah, representative's probably okay too.
Paul Ryan is okay with you.
Yeah, I'd be okay with him. He's been disappointing this last year, but all of this is getting us away from our main topic, which we should probably wrap up. Any concluding thoughts, Ed? Otherwise, we should call this. We both have places to be.
Elizabeth Warren, 2020.
Oh, good Lord. All right. I will not rise to that bait. Well, there's much more to mull over here. Check out the website at christianhumanist.org for the show notes and the various readings we've mentioned. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please do take a look at the other podcasts in the family as well and leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. You can also check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or send us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. I went a-walkin' that ribbon of high.